Call the House Resources Committee to order. In attendance, we have Representatives Gatto, Olson, Rammer, Samuels, Seaton, Ledoux, and Crawford. We've also been joined by the Minority Leader Representative Berkowitz and Representative Wilson. Today, we will have a presentation from Econ One, who had been hired by the legislature as an independent economist. We hate to say goodbye to Representative Berkowitz and Wilson, but we will probably be limiting discussion after today once we have a CS in front of us to committee members only, and we've discussed that before.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
Goodbye, but not farewell.
Yeah, goodbye, not farewell. Well, we have no illusions about it. I just wanted to clarify what we're going to do here. Obviously, continuing with House Bill 488. And with that, Barry, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and,
yes,
and Tony?
Yes.
And,
thank you, Chairman Samuels, Chairman Ramirez, committee members and legislators. My name is Barry Pulliam. I am a senior economist with the firm of Econ One Research. I have sitting here beside me a colleague, Dr. Tony Finizza, who is working with us at Econ One. He is also an economist. And I'll tell you a little bit more about our particular backgrounds in just a minute. I'd say, as a preliminary matter, we're very happy to be here, to be able to help you grapple with, struggle with, and analyze this severance tax matter, the PPT, and hopefully by the end of all this, try and give you some insights and help you to make the decisions that you need to make. Let me first tell you just a little bit about who Econ One is. We are a research, economic research and consulting firm. We're headquartered in Los Angeles, but we have offices in Sacramento, Houston, and Austin as well. We provide economic consulting services to a variety of clients in a variety of industries. Much of our work involves the petroleum industry and the natural gas industry. We have, over the past 20 years, worked for a number of state governments, including, importantly, the state of Alaska. We have worked for the state of Alaska since dating back to the mid-80s on a number of matters, and pretty much worked for the state on a continual basis. Sometimes the activity is higher, sometimes it's lower. But since that point, since the mid-80s, we've been working for the state in one capacity or another. And that work involves advising folks at the Department of Natural Resources, at the Department of Revenue, as well as at the Department of Law. And over the last year or so, we have been working for the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, advising on issues involving the gas line. In addition to the state of Alaska, we have advised agencies in the state of California, Hawaii, Louisiana, New Mexico, New York, and Texas on petroleum-related matters. We've also worked for a number of federal government agencies, the Department of Justice, the Federal Trade Commission, the Department of Interior, and we worked for the President's Council of Economic Advisors a number of years ago when the issue of the ANS export ban came up, and the question, you know, this was in the mid-90s, when they were deciding, trying to decide would lifting the ban on exporting ANS hurt the West Coast. And we worked for the President's Council of Economic Advisors and advised them no, in fact, it would be a good thing to lift the export ban, and a long overdue thing. We've also worked for a number of foreign countries and international agencies, the World Bank, and a number of other countries that you see there, mostly on issues related to how to structure regulated industries, whether to privatize some of those industries. We've also worked for petroleum and natural gas companies. We've worked for BP a number of times, for Occidental Petroleum, refiners, producers, and pipeline companies. So we have a wide variety of of experience. Just very quickly about myself, I'm an economist with Econ 1. I started out in the late 80s working on issues for the state of Alaska, issues involving royalty payments, royalty valuation. Since that time, I have assisted the state on a number of matters involving royalty valuation, involving severance tax valuation. I've assisted the state with a number of audits on severance taxes and income taxes. I've assisted the state in helping to draft regulations on severance taxes. I've worked for the state on analyzing issues involving the TAPS Quality Bank before the FERC and the what's now the RCA. I've also worked for the state on a number of occasions looking at whether or not mergers or acquisitions in the petroleum industry could lead to potential harm to consumers. And most recently, I worked for the Department of Natural Resources and Department of Law in the reopener, the royalty reopener that, that the state had with Exxon involving their royalty settlement agreement. In addition to my work with the state here, I've worked with a number of other states on similar types of issues with the federal government, Department of Interior, and the Federal Trade Commission. I have also, as I said in the prior slide, our firm has worked for a number of petroleum companies. I, as well, have worked for a number of petroleum companies over the years. Dr. Finizza, we're very happy to have Dr. Finizza working with us at Econ 1. He has a very distinguished career as an economist. He's a PhD from the University of Chicago. He was ARCO's chief economist for 23 years. At ARCO, he was in charge of forecasting planning, looking at investment decisions. He currently is retired from ARCO. as everybody who once worked for ARCO is someplace else now. He currently, in addition to working with us and doing some other things, he teaches forecasting and modeling at the University of California, Irvine. And I'll let him, actually we're gonna, I'll talk a little bit about how we're gonna divide this up. Dr. Finizza is gonna talk initially about issues involving price forecasting, involving investment decision making, and involving the economics of exploration. As you know, one of the rationales and reasons for structuring the proposed tax as it is that it would spur exploration, and we share that that view. It's an important piece, I think, to understand, and something that Dr. Finizza is going to take you through. After he is finished, I will talk to you about the impacts of the PPT on current production and production from reserves that the state knows about. That'll be the format that we follow. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tony.
We're going to do a switching seats routine here. Thank you. Glad to be here, and hope that you'll find something useful from what we say today. You've had a lot of presentations by economists. I hope you're not numb. We'll try to keep that in mind. One of the ways I thought of my job at ARCO was to keep senior management intellectually honest, try to keep them from following their biases too closely and perhaps giving them new insights. So that is what a chief economist is at an oil company. At ARCO, we used to give new people a test called the Almanac Quiz Test. I don't know if any of you have heard of that. I now use that to humble people. You have a set of 100 Almanac questions that can be answered true or false, and they're easily verifiable, like who is the third president of the United States, and if you said Thomas Jefferson, you're proud of yourself. That's not the idea of the test. The idea of the test is, how sure are you? And so the test is not, did you get the question right, but how sure were you that you knew the answer? So we'd ask each participant to rate their answer. Are they 50% sure? In other words, are they flipping a coin? Are they 99.9% sure? That means it will happen, or they are sure it's going to happen, or that's the right answer, or gradations between 60, 70, 80, and 90. I think I've administered that to hundreds of people, and no one has gotten an A-plus on it. And very few people get an A, and most people get gentleman C's, because we do have to keep one thing in mind. We cannot really know how sure we are of things. That's of things in the almanac. So you can imagine what that must be true about the future. So I hope you understand the things I'm going to talk about. The future is very uncertain. Not that we need to know that. Now, if anyone wants to be humbled by that almanac quiz, I'll offer them an opportunity to score on that at any time in the future. That's an open invitation.
Give it to the whole House?
Sure. Well, there might be a debate whether the House and the Senate knows me. The first part of my presentation is going to is related to oil price issues. And I thought it might be useful to try to tell you where I'm heading, and here are my kind of conclusions and observations. And they are the following. The important thing is what forecasts are the risk takers in exploration and development using. Not what you would like, and not what they would like, but what are they going to be using? What do they really plan their future on? And so I'm going to offer some evidence that people in the industry are using more or less $40 WTI as a planning base case, with 30 as a stress price case. In other words, they will test their adventures and projects a kind of a $40 planning base case with an eye towards what would happen if prices actually didn't transpire that high and they were at $30 a barrel. And they would want to make sure that at 30 it was still a going concern and they weren't going to lose their shirt.
Representative Ramos.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt you, Doctor. What would you say 50 represents WTI as a price? Bless you.
Chairman Ramos, I think 50 is perhaps a best estimate that a number of publicly available forecasters might be using. I don't think that is out of bounds, but I don't think that the industry would be using that as a planning case. So, not yet, anyway.
So a follow-up, Mr. Chairman. So if one might say that 30 is a stress price, and at 40 is a planning base case, then 50 might be the other bookend to 30. And somewhere in between 30 and 50, you're capturing almost any economic project. Is that a reasonable approach?
In a moment, I'll show you a chart of a wider range, I think, one might use. But an upside case might be higher than 50.
Okay, thank you.
Chairman Ramos, I don't think price distributions are symmetric. I think there is oftentimes a higher upside than a downside.
Thank you.
The second conclusion would be that this range is consistent with publicly available forecasts, although you saw the recent Department of Energy's annual energy outlook, which uses something around $54 as their base case, 54, and you convert it to WTI. I guess I already indicated the third bullet here. What really matters when thinking about the impact of things is what are the people who are making decisions and taking the risks using. And I again want to remind everyone that forecasters have been humbled in the past and will continue to be humbled. So we have to keep that in mind. I've heard a lot of talk in my two trips to Juneau since the beginning of the year about high oil prices and low oil prices. And I think that there are reasons for not expecting either of those cases. And when I mean real high, I heard numbers $150 a barrel, and I've heard numbers of $20 a barrel. I don't believe that those are very likely scenarios. There are factors suggesting higher prices, and we see them every day. Strong oil demand, particularly in Asia. We've been quite surprised by that. All forecasters, I think, were caught off guard by that. When someone does the arithmetic of looking at the available supply that OPEC is going to have to provide to the market, They see this demand that's growing very high, very fast, and there's not enough supply in the non-OPEC world to keep track, keep up with that. So there has to be an increase in people's view of oil from OPEC. That's going to put upper pressure on oil prices. There are factors opposing continued higher prices. As higher prices remain part of the landscape, there will be alternative energies brought into the market. And if you look at the economics of things like tar sands, coal liquids, shale oil, you would start to see them, not on day one, but as people see a long-term price range that's above their break-even price, you'll start to see the onslaught of that. Also, the use of oil is predominantly a transportation fuel in most parts of the world, particularly in the United States. We're seeing the inroads of alternative propulsion systems, the hybrid electric vehicles. Now they're coming in with this talk about the plug grid-connected hybrid electric vehicles. All of these are coming into the market because of high prices. So that will have a way of setting a cap on that over the long run. Also, whenever anyone wants to throw around the number $150 forever, just remember that for every $10, this is like adding a tax to the consumer. Each $10 difference is roughly $73 billion. You don't have to have many of those to start tanking the economy. I'm going to just show you very quickly pictures of oil price forecasts for your use and information. The first one is the Department of Energy's forecast, which a number of companies use and cite. Then the International Energy Agency, the Paris group. I'm a fan of polling experts and then taking the median value. I'll show you a recent poll of 10 analysts. And then I also like to look at what the market says, the NYMEX futures market. And they always generally support the $40 idea, but there are up $40 and up as the most likely case. The EIA every year publishes their annual energy outlook. You'll notice on this chart that I created, I put P20 and P80. P20 means there's a 20% chance that prices would be below the line and an 80% chance above the line. You won't find this on their website. I created this myself. The Department of Energy is using a Delphi panel for the first time. They didn't report results because you never report results the first time you do anything. You could be embarrassed. But they've made a great strides towards bringing in outsiders to help do a range of forecasts.
Representative Seaton.
Would you explain that, P20 and P80?
Yes. Well, let me just start by explaining the base case. The base case is what EIA says is the expected price path. But there's a range of uncertainty around that. So the P20 line, which is red, is the probability that prices will remain below that line. So there's 1 in 5 chance the prices would be under $30. These are in, as you can see, $2,000. And the yellow line, which actually kind of spreads, doesn't level off like the P20, says there's an 80% chance that prices will be below that line. Or the reciprocal, there's only a 20% chance it would be above there. So if I were saying, looking at the year 2030, and I was a Department of Energy analyst, I would say between, say, roughly 30 and 80, I will find something like 60% of the likely cases of oil prices.
So would you consider the base case then as a P50?
Actually, the P50 refers to a median. This is not exactly the same, but it comes close.
Okay, thank you. Representative Crawford and then Ledoux.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've heard people say that if the U.S. gets cold, then China gets gets pneumonia as far as you know, their exports and all, and that would have a tendency to to bring their economy way down. What happens if we go into a recession? Are any of these scenarios taken into account a possibility of a recession?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, none of these expect any recession, but it uses an average economic growth rate. So rather, none of this depicts a specific recession. It assumes that we will be growing somewhere around 2.5% a year on average over this time period. You're right about the impact. If you had a recession, it would have a devastating impact on oil prices, as it did the last couple of times we've had recessions.
Follow up?
Yes.
Well, it seems that there's a nationwide tightening of credit going on and a slowing of the housing market. It seems like that's been what has been powering our economy for the last couple of years. And if we're going to stop buying houses to the extent that we have been, it seems that we're in for some rocky times.
May I make a prediction here? That there will be a recession between now and 2030, and we will have serious deviations from these trend lines. None of them, I would say, no one is expecting a permanent depression or anything of that sort.
Thank you.
Representative Lodeau.
You see these outlooks and these forecasts, extend quite a few years. So I'm thinking back like 10 or 15 years. Did anybody anticipate how lousy the oil prices would be just a few years ago?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, not at the time. In hindsight, everyone says they had an inkling of that. But I'm going to show you in a few seconds, a few minutes, some of the forecasts made by organizations. You see how far they are off the mark. And I'm almost embarrassed to talk about things out 2030. That's a long time from now, and a lot of things can happen then, and we will be surprised many times along the way, I'm sure.
So it's almost sort of like the weather.
Well put. This is a recent poll, it's last Friday, was reported in Reuters, of 18 oil analysts disguised for obvious reasons. I've looked at the median of these 18 analysts, and this is a look at the year 2010. What do you expect oil prices to be in the year 2010? The median of this group says $40. The mean is a little higher. It's better to use a median is much preferred when you do a poll, that so that outliers have no influence on the answer. If you want to get a consensus, you don't want someone saying $1,000, because then that would bias the sample, but in a median sense, it would have no impact. So again, that's another evidence that maybe 40 is kind of a prevailing value of what people think prices will be. The International Energy Agency last year had their long-term oil price forecast. I wasn't able to get the data in time to draw my own graph, so I took it and edited it by taking all the extraneous lines out. But what they have is a picture that a lot of people follow. That is, they...
Representative Guerra.
I'm sorry.
When you're done, and I'll...
Okay. The other point I want to make here is this is a lot of people forecast the long term, like this one does, $40, and they draw a line down to hitting kind of a projection towards 40. So they recognize the market might get weaker, but then you're heading towards 40. So again, this is evidence that we're in a $40 world.
Can you just give us your best estimate of we're measuring everything in terms of an ANS price. So can you just give us your best estimate of how different an ANS price over the long term should be to a WTI price?
Well, the current difference is $7. West Coast, $2.
So ANS is $2 lower currently.
Yeah.
Fair estimate that that's how we should project it in the future?
We might have a difference of opinion here, but yeah, I think that would be a reasonable.
But what you told us yesterday or the day before, whenever we sat down, is that it's usually $2, it's not a percentage, it's 2 at 60, but it's also 2 at 20. So there's no way to judge a percentage basis. Anyway, Representative Brammers, do you have a question?
I was just recognizing two economists, and you're going to have two different opinions?
At least.
Three if one of them's from Harvard. This is a picture of the WTI spot price with the view at points in time by the New York Mercantile Exchange futures market. This was taken at the end of January, and I compared it against of the March month going out 8 or 10 years, and I compared it with what the market was saying the same day 3 years prior. And generally what that market will tell you, it almost always reverts to a lower price. So the market is always looking to kind of revert to a mean, head down to the average it's been in the long over long periods of time. The current strip is keeping us in the $60 range. So that's about the only evidence that's higher than the 40 plus numbers we see in other sources. So that's how I concluded, and also with in talking to people and keeping my eyes and ears open and knowing how producers behave in terms of price forecasting, my best guess would be that they will test their projects at a price path in the $40 range, possibly even lower. And then the stress test their projects at $30. They will see, does this work at 40? Do I get a decent rate of return, which we'll talk about in a while? But I want to make sure that at $30 or what I would view my stress test, that I wouldn't make, that would at least cover my costs, that I wouldn't, in a normal return, I wouldn't go out of business.
Okay. Representative Gatto.
Thanks. I just want to be sure, the previous graph, the blue line represents what actually happened. And the colored lines were forecasts at those times.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, yes. The blue line are the actual WTI spot prices and current dollars, and those are the NYMEX views of the future, so to speak, at that point in time.
How is the view collected? Is that a compilation of a dozen people? Or
this is actually these are prices derived from contracts actually traded. People are buying and selling oil futures that far in advance.
Thank you.
Representative Brammers.
Just to elaborate on that point a little bit, I like Alaska Airlines, for instance, I know purchased a lot of strips out into the future at $20 barrel oil a few years ago, which is how they have weathered this storm so well. So, for instance, using the green line, for instance, if Alaska Airlines were to have bought strips on that green line, then as oil went up to $60 a barrel, they would have purchased it out into the future years at that lower price. And so where a strip being sold today is off that red line. Is that right? So people are buying out into the future on the red line right now, projecting that out. So those that are buying strips are trying to hedge against the future by buying on the red line. Is that correct?
Yes, Chairman Ramos. You can purchase oil at $60, $65 seven or eight years out in the future, yes. Thinking for those who want to protect themselves against much higher prices. And they're willing sellers as well. Can we tell from recent asset transfers and purchases what companies might be viewing? And I think we can with a tilde sign, which means maybe or approximately. The recent acquisitions of Gulf of Mexico assets would have been sensible at something like $40 a barrel. Last year, the acquisitions late in the year and early in the year would be more like $30 to $35. So I think this is indicative of the $40 price, $35 to $40 price being a planning assumption. I've offered to give you some examples of humbling oil price forecasting just to remind you that we will be possibly surprised. And there are going to be three. the government forecasts, a private oil company, which will go unmentioned forecasts, and a poll of experts. This is a picture of the EIA annual energy outlooks that stretch back to 1986. You can see in that box, they call them AEO 1986, et cetera. They're currently at AEO 2006. And the the blue line that actually wiggles around and very close to the bottom is the actual price. So you can see that at times they were very optimistic and proved wrong. Recently, they were getting closer to the actual. The AEO 2005 was way, and I don't have that depicted, I'm sorry to say. It was way under, and now they've moved up again to a much higher number. So the EIA forecasts suffer from the same forecasting records that we all have. I won't spend a lot of time on this one. This is a view of prices of in long-range plans of an oil company, with the black being the actual. I want to point out that, for example, if it was said the 1985 long-range plan, that would be done in 1984 in anticipation of the 1985 and onward period. The dark black is the actual prices, and much of this was optimistic. There are two points that bear mentioning on this one, and that is if you notice the 1985 LRP in the left-hand part of the screen and the actual, the LRP actually showed a decline in price well before the decline hit. That forecast was made in the year 1984, and we of course know that it was 86 where we had the fall in OPEC. So that was a darn good short-term planning case. Of course, it then had bent up and ended up in the high 50s in the 1990s when that was way off the mark.
Representative Olson.
It's my understanding that EIA is not using ANWR production in their long-range
Correct.
Forecast.
Yes. Representative Olson, the feeling of the EIA in their base case is they will put in policies that are in place, not anticipate policy change. So they, in fact, do not put in things like that.
But they are a follow-up, please?
They do have an estimate of what ANWR would bring.
But they are using future gas line production in 2015 and 2016 in their forecast?
For gas.
For
gas, yes.
Yeah.
Representative Croft, you have a question?
Yeah. Is there any idea that the forecasters tend to forecast sort of their current environment projected to infinity? It always seemed like that to me. I remember when we had very low oil prices, people coming to testify before House Finance saying, we're in a new paradigm and oil is going to be from 15 to 20 for the rest of our lives. And now we're hearing testimony that we're in a new paradigm and it's going to be 60 to 100 for the rest of our lives. Do you get the sense as you look at the forecasting errors that have been made that they just the mistake is projecting your most recent experience out?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, you're absolutely right. We call it anchoring. People tend to start where prices are at the moment they're doing the forecast, believing there's a reason for it being much higher than the past, and try to make up stories about a change in paradigm and go from there. They're also, these forecasts actually are used for something. And in fact, can you imagine if someone was trying to operate an oil company in which they had a much divergent view than the rest of the industry? Say they were very optimistic, unreasonably optimistic, whereas the rest of the industry was not, they would be probably bankrupt. They would invest in projects that were not economic. If they're in fact much lower than the range of forecasts, they would actually leave commercial projects on the table. So that in a way you can't stray too much from the pack, and I think that leads to part of the anchoring as well.
Okay. Follow up, Representative Croft.
So that sort of safety in the herd idea, but the actual price of oil over a long period of time, and particularly nominal dollars, has been pretty consistent. We see wild forecasts, but in fact, it seems to me the safest is that it's going to, that it, when it gets too high, people find other things they can use for fuel, and when it gets too low, people find more, and that the safest is just right along that 15 to 25 in nominal price. Well, are there people following that, or, because it has stayed within a relative, the forecasts haven't, but the price in nominal dollars has stayed within a fairly tight range.
Representative Croft, in order to give you the benefit of a century, this is a picture of 105 years of oil prices, and you can see there are periods of time where you do have vast and sharp deviations from what you just said, and it's in those periods that you could actually make or lose a lot of money. So if someone were to look at this chart and kind of say, I offer you, would you put a ruler up there and tell me what you would forecast? Because I think a lot of people might be tempted to take a $30 number or a $40 number rather than the 50 or 55 that is at the tail end. So there are many ways of doing this, unfortunately.
Thank you.
My last example of a humbling forecast was a poll done and I feel I can pick on people because I've made all these mistakes myself, and I've participated in this poll over time. No longer, the Society of Petroleum Evaluation Engineers asks about 150 people in the industry who know something: bankers, economists, consultants, drillers. What they think the oil price will be, and in this period of time, you can see that they understated quite severely the forecast of oil. So that's my lesson or exposition on humbling forecasts, and I hope I made the following points to you: that $40 range with a stress test of 30 is, I think, what people will be looking at in judging projects in this in the going forward environment, and everyone recognizes the range of uncertainty is very wide, and they expect errors, and they will commit errors. Next, I'd like to look at a question that was posed to us, and that is, how would you think the various PPT arrangements impact exploration? And I've taken a crack at that. And I'd like to give you my results before Barry takes over and takes us back to the bigger picture. For the metrics I want to use here, I'm going to use two things, and that is I'm going to try to bring everything to a net present value analysis. I'm going to look at the a project and try to say what is the present value of that venture, and then measure and compare it with what I think people would be looking for in explorers might be looking for. And I'd also look at an internal rate of return, which is a way of looking at the at what rate are the cash flows from the net present value of a project equals zero. So I can see if it kind of is better than the hurdle rate that I might have set for myself. And something I'm looking at something in the 15% range with a look down to 12. So if a project doesn't substantially pass a 15%, I probably would think about passing on it. A lot of people will use just some of the cash flows in an undiscounted way, and economists don't like to do that because of the fact that we value a bird in the hand, that future value of dollar is not worth as much as a current value of that same dollar. So I'm going to use everything in a discounted way. So let me take you through what I would call the economics of new fields. First, I have to give you a caveat. I am not an explorer. I do my gambling in Las Vegas. And I'm going to give you a high-level first glance. Oil and gas explorers will be able to give you their opinion and may even a more detailed opinion. But I'm trying to give you an impression of what, at first glance, if someone were to look at this PPT and compare, should I go into the North Slope of Alaska and explore for oil? What is it this environment going to look for me? So I will take you through that. This is the picture of a Prudhoe Bay well from the ARCO photo collection. When I first joined ARCO in the early 1970s, everyone around there was very proud of having discovered Prudhoe Bay. And everyone told the same story that they were down to pulling out, and someone said, let's do that last well, and of course it hit, and 15 billion barrels later we have a nice oil field. I heard that story hundreds of times, and they were very proud of being a part of Alaska. And in fact, by my count, there were 72 people that I met that claimed they were there. And I don't think it was more than a handful, but 72 people have claimed to have an influence in drilling that last well. My conclusions about the exploration impacts of this is the following. And I'd like to walk through the difference between what people are saying about ANWR and the Central North Slope without ANWR being considered. And you all probably know this, but I'm just trying to package in a way that will help your thinking.
Representative Guerra.
Yes.
Thank you. Doctor, if you're able to, as you go through this and you compare 2020 to 2520 under your various scenarios, can you also, if you're able, factor in sort of the preliminary recommendation of Mr. Johnston, which was 2520 and then higher from that at higher prices, and if you're able to as you're going through it, so we can consider a bigger range of PPT scenarios?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, Mr. Pulliam is going to show a number of sliding scale, and I haven't put this into this. I think when he gets to his part, it'll be directionally clear the impact of that, those alternatives.
Okay. And then just as when you say internal rate of return, it's easy for us to figure out profit margin, you know, profits as a percentage of gross revenue. Is that at all relatable to internal rate of return? We know the profit margins on the North Slope right now are in the 40% range.
Well, yes, let's see. Well, if you had a net present value, if you discounted your cash flow, say, at 10%, let's say, and you had a net present value that was in excess of that, that means you are getting profits beyond normal profits there. So you could think of that net present value as, in a sense, of a profit margin, I guess. And the internal rate of return is the one at which that it becomes zero, that you've just covered, they just have normal profits, basically. My other conclusions regarding the exploration impacts will be that at low prices, and I think you have to realistically expect people to be thinking low prices, as I said before, that it appears that the 2520 helps the explorer more than the 2020. I'll get into all this. I just want to telegraph where I'm heading. It seems important that incentives are required at low prices. Something is needed at low prices to get what I think you want in terms of exploration. Both the 2020 and 2520 are preferred over the status quo, and it appears from looking at the data that under either of the schemes, that basic schemes being discussed, the remaining reserves will be economic that we talk about, except for low prices. And around the $30 range, things get to be very questionable in my mind. $30 and below.
Representative Ledoux.
You say at low prices, the 2520 helps the explorer more than the 2020. Do you mean a 25% tax helps the explorer more than a 20% tax? I don't understand that.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, if you bear with me, we'd like to show how some of the sheltering that goes on by having a higher tax rate could actually help. Bear with us. This is going to be, in our model, a stylized look at a new field, and it takes a long time to get that oil out of the ground. So there's an exploration and appraisal periods, and we've picked some numbers here. Not everything's going to be the same, but this is just a model of a sample project. There might be a 4-year exploration period, at which point you may go home empty-handed, They might be all dry holes. There's a development phase where you decide that there is something there that's commercial, and I will go into a development stage, and that might take a three-year period to get the capital in place to do that, and then a production phase that goes on from that point onward. So it might be 7 years before you find the first oil going to market from an exploration.
And that's in Alaska, as you're talking about this 7-year phase with the short.
We use this example as the typical, you know, on average.
Is it? We've been told it's significantly longer because of our shorter seasons. You can go to Libya and it's 24/7. You're going. Well, we obviously have a real short season. So is it longer for us? Do you think slightly longer? It's not a valid argument as far as the development, the exploration and the development time.
Chairman Solomons, we thought this was representative of typical exploration, so Alaska might be longer in actuality.
Okay, thank you.
I also wanted to, for those who were going to make any comparisons against other studies done for the state and the administration, these are roughly the same years that Pedro Van Mures uses. To give you an idea of the technical capability of Alaska in terms of the Central North Slope and ANWR, I put this table together. These are this is a study or an analysis of the undiscovered technically recoverable oil reserves. These are not necessarily economic reserves, and this data is from the U.S. Geologic Survey, their 2005 updates. So the Central North Slope, they are saying their mean estimates, and they do the same kind of P20 and P80 that we did with the oil prices earlier. They say the mean expectation is 4 billion barrels. Not all that, again, will be commercial at $40. And that ANWR would have something over 10. And explorers might think that's even low. But the most important thing to look at, I believe, is where they think you're going to find the oil within that general area. And that is, in their study, if you look at the number of fields they expect to find more than a billion barrels of oil, in the ANWR they expect 22% of the oil to be found in fields that large, and none outside of ANWR in the Central North Slope. Whereas in the Central North Slope study, the amount of oil they're going to find in fields smaller than 64 million barrels is 51% for the Central North Slope and only 1% for ANWR. So there's a field size distribution difference that's going to make it much tougher for explorers to find oil in Central North Slope.
Representative Berkowitz.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chair. I'm noticing a distinction in your presentation between exploration and legacy fields. Does your analysis at some point talk about
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, Barry Pulliam is going to talk about the legacy fields. I'm just going to look at the question is, what is this going to do notionally towards new fields? So he's going to talk about that after I'm done.
Okay. I just want to be clear, this analysis is solely for undiscovered, unexplored.
Correct.
Fields.
Thank you. We've been talking, many of us have been talking about exempting a provision that would exempt essentially fields of 5,000 barrels a day and smaller. Can you give us, you're talking in terms of total reserves, but if people are talking in terms of barrels per day, can you give us a sense of what percentage of our fields in the future might be 5,000 barrels a day or smaller that would then escape that provision's, that proposal's production tax?
Let's see. Per day. Since it goes up and then there's a peak period, let's say I think the 50 million fields might peak at something like 4 million in a year at the peak.
12,000 a day.
So 12,000 a day. So these would all be at some point probably above that. Yeah, actually, I do. I should have just remembered what I have. We'll get that in a second.
Sure. Thanks.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Barry, on this slide right here, it says that not all these reserves are economic. Do you have any idea of these, how many are, you think, economic?
Yes, through the chair, is it Representative Wilson? I do in a couple slides. In fact, maybe I'll go there right now. Could I just go in the sequence? It'll probably be clearer. This next one shows the.
Tony, one second.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a clarification because we talked. Representative Guerra was mentioning 5,000 barrels per field, and I wanted to bring us back to PPT. We're talking about per company, and we're not talking about per field. So, if you are generating any answers based on that, I make sure. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm going to just take this couple of elements in this chart and illustrate them a little bit more in more detail. This is a look at just the non-central North Slope. So this is the USGA's view of what would be the likely field sizes in that area. And they have a distribution. So there's three bars. One's the P50 estimate, one's the expected number, and one's the P80. So again, this is, if I look at the first one, they're saying that in the central North Slope, they expect an average of 21 fields that will be 50 million barrels a day. They are 50 million barrels total. There's a 80% chance that is there's a P20. There's an 80% chance the fields will there'll be 17 fields. There'll be only a 20% chance there'll only be 17 fields. So somewhere between 17 and 24 fields of that size. And the point here that's important is if you look to the right, you see their estimates say there's a fields of 500 million barrels total, like an alpine type field. There's one. The expected value is one. And again, these are technically recoverable, not commercial. We'll get to that in a second. I just want to show the ANWR equivalent. And here you see there's a lot more larger potential fields. So that opening ANWR would change the dynamics of this considerably. Now let's get to economic. They also say, what is the likely economic size of these at various prices? And I took the 20 P20s and P80s off. I just want to show you the expected value. So here they're saying, in the Central North Slope, at $40 WTI, that's the second bar from the left, they expect economically commercially recoverable reserves of 1.9 billion barrels. And with the lag, if you started drilling today and started looking at it right now, and 7 or more years later, that would come to, and you found it now, 7 or more years later, you'd start to get it into the production mix, and then it would flow out over the next 5 to 20 years after that. So as you go with high, if you had an expectation of higher prices and you actually found some oil that you could, in fact, bring more oil on, $3 billion at $60 a barrel. But again, I was saying, I think people are focusing on the 40 range at this point. If you take that and say, what would I expect for discoveries? I'm not trying to model this. I'm assuming that people are looking at a kind of a $40 level for forever. And using those data and assuming that ANWR isn't open or isn't open soon enough to make a difference, that you might expect 20 fields to be discovered in the North Slope from now on, of which 60% would be small, 50 million barrels. 1 or 5% would be an alpine type field, 2 at 150 million barrels, and 5 at 100 million barrels. And that's what I'm going to model. I'm going to assume that that's what we can get out there. And I want to say, what would an explorer look like if they thought these were the parameters and they were facing the status quo situation or facing a PPT? How would they go about analyzing this? And those are the percentages, again, that I just cited. 60% will be 50s, 25 100s, 10 150s, and 5 500s. I'm going to look at it this way by taking the present value of all possible outcomes. And since this is a risky business, I don't think every time I drill a hole I'm going to have a success. That would not be possible. No one's ever done that. So I'm assuming in this analysis that if you drill a well, there's a 1 in 6 chance you'll get a successful commercial hit, and 5-6 it'll be a failure.
Representative Berkowitz.
I'm just curious, where does that 1 in 6 ratio come from?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, we have at the bottom, I put a little note that the Alaska experience over the 10 years, 94 to 2000, was about 18%, 17.9, so rough assumption, 1 in 16.7%, thinking that maybe it would be a little bit harder in the future.
I mean, the reason I ask the question is we hear frequently that new technology has made discovery more likely, and I'm just wondering if that's the global experience. That 1 in 6 might be somewhat of an outdated ratio.
I'd be willing to raise it a little bit, but, you know, this goes through the year 2003, and it seems like it's still in this range. So the way to look at this financial economic analysis would be that there's a 83% chance of a dry hole, so you only get negative cash flows in that world. And there's a 1 in 6 chance that you could develop the field and hopefully you will get positive cash flows, you know, subject to taxes that come out of your hide and CapEx, OpEx, state income tax, federal income tax, mitigated by government tax sheltering by allowing deductions. So that's the way I'm going to look at this process. And so just to give you a kind of a high-level schematic, when you do exploration, you'll have for 4 years or so, I've modeled it as a four-year program, cash flow, negative cash flow 100% of the time. And then if you find something, you can then spend more capital developing it, and then you start to reap the benefits of positive cash flow. And you only get that 1/6 of the time. Now, explorers want to avoid gambler's ruin. They're not going to drill one well. If you drill one well with these numbers, there's an 83% chance you'll go bust. Okay. So one way of thinking about it is you would partner up or farm out or whatever and try to lower the chance of failure. So if you did 6 wells, you only have a 33% of failing by not, in other words, not getting any wells in. And you might do 4, and that would be a 2/3. And so I chose a 6-well program, and and that is very handy because the expected number of wells out of a program like that, successful wells, is 1. And there's a chance you'll get 0, 33% chance you'll get 0, 40% chance you'll get 1 in, 1.0001 chance you'll get all 6 to hit. So we don't count on that, but we do consider it. So we will say, let's assume that we drill, have a program, sink the capital money, assess the chance of getting a well to be successful, then picking out what size field that would be. Most likely it's going to be the 60% chance it's going to be the small field, and only a 5% chance it's going to be a big field. Wait to all these cash flows and see if an explorer looks at this program favorably. That's the analysis I'm going to show you the results. And to illustrate this question that was raised earlier about is 25-20, could it look better for a producer in a funny kind of way it does, I'm saying no one's going to drill a one-well program, but just say you did, and it was $20 million, and that's the number I'm actually going to use for a well, $20 million. That's pretty expensive, but this is an expensive state, and they're low productive wells, et cetera. Eventually, we have the high-cost assumptions to make. If you did this well exploration, $20 million over the, with a pattern that I put in here, and you, under a status quo, you'd your negative cash flow would be roughly $20 million. There's an inflation in there that makes it higher, and then there's some tax sheltering that goes on. In the other cases, the PPT, you get to deduct capital as a credit, et cetera, and sell it and all that stuff. So in actuality, the producer or the explorer has less cash flow, negative cash flow. And by this calculation, marginally better off with 25-20 than 20-20.
Representative Berkowitz.
Two two questions with that. First one, could you walk us through those numbers, how you got there, just so I'm sure I understand it? And secondly, did you analyze at different rates in 2020, 25, 20? Did you do 30, 20, or anything in the spread between?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, I personally didn't do anything but these two cases. They could be done. We didn't think that was the boundaries were allowed, you know, we're presenting those possibilities. This is just to the most likely PPTs that were being contemplated, I think, is what the way I looked at it.
Okay.
So if in this, the way this is calculated by, first of all, you have to imagine the pattern of capital, which I unfortunately haven't a picture of it. You put in the expiration capital over this time period. It's not, it was like that picture I showed earlier, like this. It's something like that. It you put in, so the crescendo comes near the end of the four-year period, you in the fourth year, and then you you take off of that the you can deduct the capital expenditures being made, and then there's a tax credit for those expenditures being given. And so those all alter the cash flow there.
Representative Guerra.
Doctor, just going from 20 to 25, 20 and showing a slightly better cash flow for the Explorer, 25, 20, can we assume if we went to 30, 20 or what Johnston recommended, 25, 20 and then higher at a higher price, that the cash flow result would be maybe similar to 25, 20 or?
Yes, what's working here is the fact that you're actually allowing CapEx expenditures to be, in a sense, deducted. Someone else is helping pay for it rather than in the status quo. So the higher the tax rate, you actually can shelter more of those expenditures. Now, the idea is not that this would be the end of the project, that this would bear fruit and you'd have, with some probability, development capital and a production program. So you actually would find out if you looked at a total program, this pattern might not persist.
I'm assuming that 100 would create a problem.
I'm sorry?
I'm assuming that 100 would create a problem.
100 and any credit would be a problem, probably.
Thank you, Representative Rammers.
Thank you. Doctor, I'm struggling with more basic math than what you have presented here. What I'm going back to is the numbers that we saw from the Department of Revenue. It said that exploration plus development per year is about $1 billion a year over the last 5 years. And we saw that that exploration represented between about 7 and 10% of that $1 billion, which would be $70 to $100 million a year. That doesn't even get us to a six-well program per year, which seems precisely why we're all sitting here, which is to try and jumpstart our whole exploration program, because we're not even spending $100 million a year, which means our odds of finding a 50 million barrel field or a 100 or 150 or 500 are reduced even more so by the fact that there isn't a satisfactory amount of exploration.
Chairman Ramos, the number you quoted is roughly, would be, as you say, not even enough to cover a six-well program at $20 million. This program would bring you roughly 100 million barrels a year, which is roughly the average for Alaska over the 10 years. I didn't choose this as the entire exploration program. I just said, let's assume that this is the number. I'm really at a loss to say how much really people will spend on exploration. I have a feeling it's more, but I have no way of judging whether it's going to be more than $100 million, $120 million a year.
Representative Ledoux.
I guess I'm still having some problems with this. I mean, if somebody came to me and said, I'm from the state government and I'm here to help you, and I'm going to show you that a 25% tax rate is better than a 20% tax rate, I'd have some problems with it. I'm really confused. I'm still confused, even though you've gone over your analysis. I mean, if you follow it up, then if 25 is better than 20, maybe 30 and 35, and I mean...
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I'm not sure I can help you with another example, but let's suppose you like to go to Las Vegas and you had 1 in 6 chance of some kind of game they played there. You roll one die, and if you number 6 comes up, you win. And you don't really like to do that because you don't think that's a good deal. But what if someone in your neighborhood allowed you, said, I will allow you to, whatever you do, I'm going to give you 25% of your losses back to you. Would you be more encouraged to go on that bender in Las Vegas? Maybe. I don't know if that's a perfect analogy.
Is that a rhetorical question, Doctor?
It is.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, trying to comprehend this. Is the factor that exploration is a negative loss all the time? I mean, you're never going to make money on exploration. When you're going to make money is if you discover something and then you go into production. So if you want to stimulate exploration, exploration is always going to be a negative cash flow. So the more you subsidize that from the state, the more positive benefit there is. Sure. Although taxes aren't going to be paid until something gets into development stage. Is that basically what we're talking about?
I think that's pretty accurate. Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Berkowitz.
Thanks very much. On that point, then, where's it? You've already established that 100% tax rate is not effective. But at what point have we reached diminishing returns? Is it at 25? Is it at 30? Is it at 35? Where is that point?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, that is the question: where are diminishing returns? We don't think that either of these programs would be onerous. But I think you have to, personally, I would say you have to err on the side of not making sure you're not onerous, so you can't go too far here. I think this might become a little bit more clearer when I put the whole program together rather than just the complete loss phase. And what you put in here has to be for other parts of the system as well.
I understand, but if we're seeking that point we need to know where diminishing returns is before we determine whether it's onerous. And it seems to me knowing where diminishing returns exist is a number that we ought to have.
Representative Berkowitz, that is the $64 question. I don't think anyone honestly can answer that. There's no diminishing returns rule analysis that can be done, in my opinion.
But you could run a 30-20 number. You could run a 35-35 right. number, and we'd be able to compare based on this hypothetical.
I think here's what we'd be missing, and I think this might be clear when we put the whole thing together. If you encourage too much exploration, if you subsidize too much exploration, it may not be economic. You will be losing money. The state bears a risk here too. If you encourage more exploration and prices don't warrant that as commercial exploration, you'll have wasted money. So what's the measure we're trying to do here? It's not how much exploration we're going to get, but how much commercially economic exploration. I don't think I can help on that answer. I think it's more, but I think the diminishing returns probably are set. If I had a gut feel on this, I can't do it analytically, I think you'd probably add it with this 25-20. I think it might be there, but that's gut feel.
Representative Crawford, Curtula, and then Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question for you is way more basic. And that's the efficacy of going to a profits-based tax. It seems to me that when you change from a production-based tax to a profits-based tax, then that you're leaving it open to manipulation of what a profit is. And if you, I mean, what your opinion of you know, if is this a right thing to do, to go to a profits-based tax rather than a severance tax based on production?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, I think I've heard a lot of, I watched the gavel to gavel myself in California, and I heard a lot of testimony, and I thought it was pretty persuasive that the ELF system was broken, and that a much fairer, if I can use that word in quotations, system might be one that allows people to cover their costs.
Just if I could break in there.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
I agree that our present system is broken. But, I mean, there are lots of production severance taxes around the world that I think are probably working. Compare us to, I mean, not compare our present system, but compare what we're going to as opposed to what you think is the best system around.
I personally think that's stretching my expertise to say what I would say is the best system. I think, generally speaking, something that allows cost recovery in there, as this is an example of that, would be a good system. The fact that there might be 150 different fiscal regimes in the world, some are good and some are bad. I think this is generally a reasonable approach.
And if you could say, what is it that is what keeps keeps it down, you know, the ability to game the system?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, I think you may be using gaming in terms of what will people use as what they will use as cost items to do that is could be a concern, but I think there are a lot of safeguards in that people have in Alaska and other places have ways of defining what goes in and auditing what goes in. I think that's a problem that can be easily avoided or mitigated.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Curtula.
To the 2520 or higher, is it because you're going to be able to get the deductions and the credits on the higher number? Is that what it is?
Yep.
What if you went then to 3530? What if you're giving even more deductions and credits? Wouldn't that also commensurately make it so that the higher tax rate was acceptable?
Well, the arithmetic would show that in this particular example. The question is, would you be willing as a state to run the risk of taking a big loss at that level in a failed exploration program? And I think when I put this together, it might be clear, and we may not get to that clarity, but I'm going
to
try.
We'll try to keep moving on here because you might get to answer some of these questions. Representative Gatto.
I'll pass.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Just to follow up, so I'm clearer in your answer to Representative Berkowitz, he asked you, you said at 2520 might be the point where you start maximizing revenues before you start hitting diminishing returns. Did I understand that fairly?
I said I had a gut reaction that was a point of diminishing returns, and that's
for an expiration,
yeah. I wouldn't think that you would have to go further than that to encourage, or you wouldn't, and then take a greater risk yourself.
Am I wrong in assuming, if I'm looking for the point where you've started to maximize your long-term state revenue, but before you start losing money because you're taxing too much, that's your gut reaction on 2520, or am I missing?
That's my gut reaction, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is a picture of the production profiles that I'm modeling, and as someone had earlier asked whether what's the per day rate. You can just see them off here. Some of them
The small field peaks about 5 million barrels a year, so you divide by 365, and the big fields get to be considerably on stream longer and take a while to get up there. I'm going to look at the economics of a six-well exploration program, assuming there's a success here, not just the failure part of it. So we went through a six-well exploration program, and the field we found was a 50 million barrel field. I'm then going to show you an analysis where I put all the possibilities together. This is just an illustration of how I'm doing it. So hold your answers about is this good or bad until we see the everything put together. For example, if I look at the total cash flow that an explorer would get discounted by 10% at $30 a barrel without this $73 million allowance people have been talking about, they found a high cost, low productive, the small field, which is the predominant one we think they would find, their net cash flow would be minus $80 million over, you know, with that size program. It would be, with the PPT, it would be somewhere in the mid-30s, negative. So if an explorer thought they were going to be finding these kinds of fields and these kind of prices, they wouldn't be exploring, in my opinion, if that's what they thought they were going to be getting. Now, they know they're going to get some of the larger fields. So that's one example. At $40, things start to make a profit here. You do better under the 25-20 for the explorer. And there's going to be a crossover point. I'm going to show you that as well. But let me now put it together. Let me just show the impact of now adding the $73 million allowance. If you, I'm going to flip this from, they're roughly in the same spot on the page, so you should pretty well follow it, and you all have copies. That would change the negative to closer to a smaller negative, but the explorers would still have, at $30, a negative position. But, when they put it with their larger fields, they would also likely find, we might find a different story. So let me put that total look at a six-well exploration program without the 73 allowance. So I'm going to get 6% chance I'm going to get a small well, 25, and a 100, and a 5% chance of a really big well, and a 15% chance of a 10% chance of a 150. And I'm going to just reveal this to you all know the answer, but under the status quo system, you get that minus 35 million. So if you thought that we were at a $30 world, under the existing severance system, you would have a loss position if you're an explorer. You would not get a return that was anywhere near your hurdle rate. But higher prices, you would have done better, but of course, you're not betting on that. You already have a risky venture. You probably would be satisfied. That's why I'm saying you look at the 40 and you stress test it against the 30, and it doesn't pass muster at 30. So this would be not a good exploration proposition, in my mind, if that's the kind of field size distribution you are going to get in Alaska. Now, if you went the wrong way. Now, if you look at opening up to the alternative PPTs programs, you would see that if someone were looking at a stressed at a expected price of 40, it looks fairly decent. I'm getting above 15% IRR. And if I stress test it at $30, I'm getting some economic profit there. So I feel a little bit more comfortable. So if I were an explorer, I probably would feel a little bit more comfortable about this program, but it's still on the edge. With the 73 allowance in there, I now find myself more comfortably in achieving the kind of financial performance that I want. I'm getting higher IRRs. I have, at the stress price case 30, gotten an IRR that's at the fringe of a hurdle that I would want. So it looks to me like in this kind of environment, that a 73, some kind of incentive like that would be very important to have for exploration, whether it's 73 million or some other program that, or formula that gets that kind of dollars to them would be helpful. And of course, I just showed you, I spent all my time looking around the $40 and $30 range because I think that's what people are going to be making the no-go decisions. You've got to get them over that hump. And this is a chart that puts those numbers. I'm using tables when I want you to read the numbers, but I'm using charts for impressions. And here it is, and that is, if you look at the yellow line, that's the revenues to the state, and also discounted by 10% with the allowance. And you see that under that system, you would have collected more in the old severance and less in the future. Now, if you go to a PPT of 2020, you are giving up some of that at the low end, but getting it, making up for it in a sense, at higher prices. And the crossover point in this one is this particular program was, you know, as you see it there.
Question Berkowitz.
I just want to make sure I understand that. You're saying that the current system is better for the state at under $50 oil price?
I'm sorry, I was...
I just want to make sure I understand what this graph tells us. You're saying that the status quo delivers more money to the state at under $50?
From this exploration program. Just this exploration example I used.
At under 50.
Okay. If they were to do it. But we probably wouldn't, you know, that's nothing more than drawing this this line here, but they wouldn't, no one would in their right mind go into exploration under those conditions, so there might not be exploration taking place. This is a notional kind of line. At $30, if you did explore and you did bring the field on, you would have severance tax of that sort, but it would be a losing proposition for the explorer. They might not go into it in the first place.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. So in other words, that's very possibly why we didn't see as much exploration lately as we could have if it was different.
Representative Crawford, in a low oil price world, that is one of the risks that exploration, absolutely. So my final conclusions before I turn over to Barry are the same as I had before, and I'm just repeating them here for the sake of completion, that ANWR is going to be a critical point, and you don't have it open. Without it, you should expect lower size fields. That's going to make it very hard for explorers. It's very likely that incentives will be needed to get a certain amount. I expect that this program is going to get you more exploration. I don't know how much more, and I don't think anyone can tell you that with any precision, that either of these systems is preferred over the status quo at low prices. And in an ironic way, the higher tax rate shelters more of the cash flow in a risky venture like this. Under $30 a barrel, I wouldn't expect all of these reserves to be available commercially, but above $30, if the exploration program does come forward, you should expect to get a sizable amount of oil from these reserves.
Thank you. You have next
turn it over to Barry.
Chairman Samuels, committee members and legislators, I'm going to try and take us out a little bit from the risky, harsh conditions of the Explorer into the little more warm and cozy
conditions of the reserves that are already in place. Let me start with a picture here that I think most of you, if not all of you, are familiar with. What I've done here is graph out the historical average severance tax rate over the entire North Slope, and that's on the left side of the chart. And then on the right side of the chart is what the Department of Revenue is forecasting the severance tax rate will be going forward based on the operation of the ELF. And that's really what is driving most of this change. There's a little bit back early on, particularly some of these movements earlier that you see, where you have fields when they're first in production. You know, the first 5 years they're taxed at 12.25%, and then they go up to 15%.
Representative Remmers.
Thank you. Barry, then if we end up with a severance rate that's at 15%, an actual severance rate after credits, after the whole thing, then not only are we several times or by multiple higher than this, but we're actually as high as we historically ever have been, going all the way back into the early late 70s when this was implemented. Is that right?
Yes, Chairman Ramirez, that's true. And I'm also going to, as I go through this, put this in conjunction with prices. These are the historical rates you've had. I want to put those in the context of the historical prices versus projected rates at different price levels. Perfect. Because that's one of the things that the PPT does, is it the operation of it changes the effective tax rate as prices change.
Thanks. Good question. Can we let him get?
I'd like to know what the term.
Senator Berkowitz.
I'd like to know what the term effective tax rate is when you use it.
Effective tax rate, the way I use it, and this is the way the Department of Revenue has used it as well, is to look at the tax rate as if it is on the wellhead value of the oil. What's the effective rate that you get if you were calculating taxes as they currently are now, just on the wellhead value? So when we're looking at the current severance tax plan, it's really simply just looking at what those, it's the nominal rate times the ELF, weighted by the volumes across the fields, and that's the effective tax rate. When you look at the PPT, under that approach, you get additional deductions. You don't stop with just the wellhead value, but you get to deduct operating and capital costs, and you get some credits. What we do is take the ultimate tax that you receive at whatever price you receive it and figure out what that tax is as a percent of wellhead value to put it on an apples-apples. And I think that you'll see a lot of that in the stuff I do. I think it's a very important thing to look at. But I just wanted to put this up here and remind folks, in case you didn't need reminding, why we're here in big part. I want to take that historical line and put some prices with it. So what I've got here is on the red line is the effective tax rate that you saw in the prior chart. And the blue bars are the wellhead value. So this is what taxes have been paid across the North Slope, netted back to the wellhead. And as you can see, there's been some, you know, changes over the years, ups and downs, and more recently ups, consistent with some of the figures Dr. Finizza was showing. Let me give you some statistics here. On average, the wellhead value for the entire period has been about $15 a barrel. Now that's in nominal terms, so those are dollars of the day. They're not, you know, those aren't 2006 dollars. If I converted those into 2006 dollars, in other words, inflation adjust them, that $15 a day would be about $24. So in 2006 terms, the average wellhead value on the North Slope has been about $24 a barrel. You've had an average tax rate, as you'll see later on, that has been about 12%. So 12%, $24 a barrel in 2006 terms. Just by the way, $24 a barrel wellhead today would translate into a WTI equivalent of about $32. So in today's prices, first half of 2006, we're looking at probably $62 WTI. I've charted, I won't spend a lot of time on these next ones. I've put that same picture for each of the major fields. So if you're interested in going back and looking at how it's different, you can. The one point I'll make is if this is Prudhoe Bay at the start. The decline in the ELF hasn't been as dramatic there. The next chart, which is Kuparuk, you're probably familiar with. You've had a tremendous drop-off in the ELF at Kuparuk and the tax rate at Kuparuk. And then finally, I've got the Alpine field here. It hasn't been in production that long, and only during this since 2001. The red line at Kuparuk, if we were going to look out going forward, because it is now a field that is over 5 years old, it will be going to the 15% nominal tax rate. So for a little while, that red line is going to go up. And then as you go out over time, it's going to start to come back down as the ELF pulls it down. Dr. Finitza talked about the exploration potential outside of Anwar. I want to spend my time talking about, talking about the forecasted volumes that the Department of Revenue has. These are volumes, and I know you heard Dr. Williams talk about their forecast, but these are volumes from the known fields, volumes that are under development and volumes that are being considered for development, but in their view, likely volumes that are going to come on. The volumes that you see here are from the fall 2005 forecast. They have just very recently, as you heard him say, updated that so that over the next 5 years, and that's that first bar there, they're projecting about 30,000 barrels a day less than what you see there. I talked to him a little bit after his testimony to get a feel for what they have. My understanding is they're going to provide some new data, update their earlier presentations to reflect the new forecast that they have on volumes. But one thing to remember is the 30,000 barrel a day reduction that he's talking about is really a pushing back of production. It's not that they're predicting there's less oil there. It's just that it's not going to come on as quickly. A couple of things that I want to point out in this chart. First off, Prudhoe Bay. I think this is, everyone knows it. It's the big field. 36% of what you have, regardless of sort of when you look at it over time, is projected to come out of Prudhoe Bay. If you add in Kuparuk with that, and I'm not talking about satellites yet, but you add in Kuparuk over the next 24 years, you've got 50% of the production coming from those two. If you add in their satellites, you're up to 65%. And if you add in Alpine, the other large field, you're up to 70%. So 70% of what you're expecting to produce over the next couple of decades coming out of Prudhoe, Kuparuk, their satellites, and Alpine. That totals that's 5.6 billion barrels. To put it in context with the kind of numbers that Dr. Finitza was talking about, the economic recovery potential. At that $40 oil expectation scenario, we would expect these volumes to be produced. We would also expect, based on the work that Dr. Finitza did, that maybe another 1.3 billion barrels would be recovered from new exploration. So if you put all that together, what you've got is that the existing stuff, what we think is going to be produced from known reservoirs is about 80% of what we're going to get, unless something unexpected happens, which it will. That number may be higher or lower, and of course it would be great if Anwar were opened, and the sooner the better, but that would change the complexion quite a bit. I mean, if you had Anwar open, then the existing known volumes would maybe be only half of what you could ultimately get. We reviewed, as a part of our work, the work that the Department of Revenue did, the projections they made and presented to you. We also reviewed the work that Dr. Van Muers did. We spent considerable time with both Dr. Van Muers and Roger Marks trying to understand their work, digging into it, trying to make sure that the numbers that you were being presented were reasonable. And I think I've heard this before as I've listened over gavel to gavel. Projections, particularly projections, and I'll have a word about this in a minute, over the kind of time period you're talking about are great, but they depend, of course, heavily on what your assumptions are. If your assumptions are reasonable, then the projections are reasonable. If the assumptions are not reasonable, then the projections are not reasonable. It is all in the assumptions. And I can tell you, I know you got a flavor of this from Dr. Finizza, you will not find two people with the same assumptions. Given the same set of data to look at, you will not find two people with the same assumptions, and that doesn't mean that either one of those set of assumptions are unreasonable. It may be that one looks at it and comes to an unreasonable conclusion, but you can have two different reasonable conclusions out of the same set of data. You've got to test it and look at it. We looked at the Department of Revenue's work, and we have from that created our own analysis of what the likely impacts of the PBT would be under a 2020 scenario. We've also looked at a 2520 and a number of alternatives, sliding scale scenarios. The thing I'd like to say first off before I get into this chart and describe it just about the process, in general we think that the numbers that the Department of Revenue presented were reasonable. They are attempting to project impacts over very long time periods. Even this chart you'll see here, it goes out to 2030, which is their projection of when the North Slope might shut down in the event that a gas line doesn't come to fruition. Now, those projections are based on a forecast of something in the low $20 per barrel for oil. We think if oil is more likely $40 a barrel, then the North Slope is economic, particularly Prudhoe Bay, economic for much longer than this. But this is already a long time to be trying to forecast. And you'll see on this chart in the bottom little box there, I've broken it down into a 10-year segment, which is fiscal year 2007 through 2016, and then the longer 24-year period, which is the potential of the life of the pipeline without gas line. I think 10 years itself is a long enough period to try and forecast with accuracy. 30 years there are reasons to do it, I understand, and we've done it here. We've done our best effort to get it right, but the world will almost certainly be different than what we project here. It doesn't mean it's not a worthwhile exercise, but in looking at this, and I think you're all aware of this, I would put a lot more emphasis in the information as to the next 10 years than I would for the whole time period.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Pulliam. Just so we understand what these numbers mean, is that the extra production tax that we get before it's deducted from the state income tax, or is that the extra money the state receives?
Well, I'll go through this entire chart and explain in detail. I was just sort of still in setup mode on this.
Sure.
But you prodded me out of setup mode now, so.
Ignore me.
No, it's okay. What I've done on this chart is to project the difference in severance taxes that you would get under the bill as it's proposed, the 2020, with the $73 million exemption and the 6-year transition period for the capital expenditures over the prior five. The numbers that you see here are in real terms. So in other words, I've inflation adjusted them to 2006 dollars. If you're interested, I can give you nominal dollars. We are projecting a 2.5% inflation increase on average over this period, consistent with what many other forecasters use for purposes of energy prices. But to keep it, and I think the Department of Revenue gave you information in 2006 dollars, and so I want to try and keep ours as consistent with that as possible. If you're interested, I can give you the nominal dollars as well. These are severance tax differences in the severance tax, the PPT versus the projected status quo. These are not total state revenues. Total state revenues would be a little bit different because of the state income tax. So the amount increase in severance tax that you get will be whittled down a little bit because severance taxes are deductible against income taxes. The Department of Revenue estimates that that amount is about 3.8%. So total revenues about 3.8% lower than severance tax impacts. The starting point for the projection that you see here is the DOR forecast production from the fall of 2005. Two important points that I want to note on there. First is it does not include Point Thompson, which would have approximately 300 million barrels, maybe more. Of oil. They don't project Point Thompson coming online unless a gas line is developed. I know there's been considerable debate over that, but for purposes of trying to match their numbers, I've left it out. I have, though, put in the Ugruk development because that is no longer, I think, open to debate. That's underway. So there's about 70 million barrels there. So bottom line is the volumes that I have here are about 70 million barrels higher than what Mr. Marks presented you. The other note I'd make is, you know, Mr. Marks presented several scenarios, a without gas line scenario, an enhanced volume scenario, a with gas line, and a enhanced volume with gas line. We could go through all of those scenarios. I don't know that it is... in our view, it wasn't as valuable for you to do all of those. We are focusing here. We've broken it into two pieces. Dr. Finizza talked about the potential for enhanced volumes, and I want to talk about the known volumes. And I think that's we can extrapolate to the other scenarios if you'd like, but this is really, I think, the guts of it. Okay, so what does this chart show? It shows that if you look at the boxes down below, that for the next 10 years, fiscal year 2007 through 2016, if prices do what the EIA tells us they are most likely to do, which is to be an average of about $54.70 in real terms for WTI, the state could expect $15.27 billion in additional severance tax revenues as a result of a 2020 PPT. No, I'm sorry, that 15.27 total, that would be an increase of about $7.47 billion over what you would expect under the status quo. The annual average difference is $747 million. The effective tax rate would be 12.4% under the PPT and about 6.3% under the status quo. If you look just to the right of that box, you'll see what the projection is for the period through 2030. The annual average differences aren't much different. Of course, the total dollars are. The PPT effective rate is not much different. And the status quo rate is obviously lower as a result of what's going on with the ELF. One thing I'll note here is that PPT effective rate that you see there, that 12.4 and 12.6, that's just slightly above the historical average that we've talked about it before. The historical average has been about 12%. I wanted to also show, I know there's been discussion and it's been back and forth about the first half of 2006 or the last half of the fiscal year 2006, show you the impact of that period. If the PPT was applied to that at the projected EIA price, that would be about $476 million in additional severance taxes.
That's for 6 months?
That's for 6 months, correct. Correct. And there,
that was my question.
Thank you.
The pricing in that period has been relatively stable, so you can, rough justice, you could chop it by month if you wanted. One other thing to note here before we go on from this is you'll see that the graph starts and then dips for the first number of years and then comes back up. A big reason for that, part of the reason for that dip is that the EIA is forecasting prices to fall a little bit before coming back up. But the larger reason is that's the transition credit that you see there in that period. It's about, you know, at a 20% tax rate, that transition credit's about $1 billion. So that is a big part of what's going on with that drop.
I can just take a break for 1 second here. It's almost noon now. We go into session at 2. What time do you go down the hall to the Senate? 3:30. We can take a short break for lunch. I realize if we get through this, and I appreciate everybody letting them get through this part of the presentation before asking a Q&A, your questions might get answered. But at the end, there's going to be some Q&A. So if we want to take a 20-minute break or, let's say, a quarter past, give you 25 minutes to go grab a bite to eat maybe. But at a quarter past, we'd like to gavel in again. If that's okay with you,
it's fine with us.
So let's take 25 minutes right now and take a brief at ease. Call the meeting back to order right now. For the record, Representative Kapsner is one who requested lunch, and she was back perfectly on time, so she gets a gold star. Okay, continuing on page 27.
Okay. I think we've talked pretty much about everything I want to have on 27. The one thing I would like to note is, I don't know if I mentioned this on the prior chart, we started our analysis with the Department of Revenue's analysis, and I think I said that we viewed, at least for the base case that they presented, the without gas line and the without enhanced volumes, that those were reasonable numbers.
And just so everybody knows, without enhanced volumes in Lamarck's presentation meant no ANWR, and that was the only change.
It meant no exploration.
And no ANWR?
Right. Well, he assumed in his model was that you'd spend $100 million a year, and under one scenario, the no enhanced volumes, you wouldn't get anything for it.
Okay.
So it's sort of a worst-case world. Now, I personally believe that if you spent $100 million for 3 or 4 or 5 years and you weren't finding anything, you'd stop spending the $100 million. So I think what he put out there was a more pessimistic view than what is likely.
Okay.
And in the work that I've done here, since we're looking at just the fields that we know about, the development we know about, there are no exploration dollars in here. There's a lot of development dollars. So we started with their work. We've made changes to it. We've changed some of the cost assumptions. We've changed the assumption about exploration. We've added some volumes in. And so we have a little bit different number than they do. We're a little bit, we show the effect of the PPT being a little bit less over the next 10 years, but then greater in the outer years. On average, we show the impact of the PPT being a little bit more than what the Department of Revenue shows.
Okay.
Okay. I've also looked at what would happen. How do these numbers compare at different price levels? The first charts that you saw were at the EIA projected price. I've looked to see what would the outcomes be at different prices, and I've looked here on this chart. You'll see at the base case, which is bolded there, those are the numbers from the prior charts, and they'll match what you saw there. But then as you work your way over to the right, I've shown the results that you would get at the EIA's at a low price forecast, so it's the P20 that Dr. Finizza put up, and then the high price, the P80, and those would translate into about a $35 WTI price or a $72 WTI price. And then finally, I've shown what the numbers would look like at $40. And then over to the far right, I've look to see what would the break-even price be for the PPT 2020 versus the status quo. And what you'll see in that the second column before you get to the end, which looks at fiscal year 2007 through 2016, our calculation would show the break-even price between PPT and status quo would be about $30.50 WTI. So a rough justice, $28.50 ANS, West Coast.
Representative Seaton.
That break-even price is you're comparing status quo ELF versus PPT. Basically, you're talking about the crossover point in the line.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's correct. The crossover point at which you would get the same revenues in real 2006 terms under the PPT versus just letting the current system go.
the current system go static, or the current system go as it's going
down? As it's going down.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
And you can see, if you look down that column, you'll see as you get to the fourth row there, it's entitled PPT effective tax rate, and you'll see that it's 6.3%. And then right below it, you'll see status quo effective tax rate. It's also 6.3%. So that's what I'm trying to match.
Okay.
And then if you look at the column that's just right next to it, I'm looking there, projecting out over through 2030, and looking to see what the answer is. And those results are shown in the bottom box, which deals with that longer time period. But over the period through 2030, the break-even price would be a little bit lower, 2880 WTI. The reason is that the status quo tax rate is lower over time. It drops down to about 5%. Okay. Just a couple things to note on this chart before we leave it. If you look at the effective tax rate under the PPT, go to the second column in, which is the low EIA low price forecast, 3540, and you'll see the effective tax rate over the next 10 years for the PPT is about 10.3%, and that is at 3540 real WTI. Now, if I compared that to our historical numbers, which we talked about a little earlier, the effective tax rate historically was about 12% at what would be about a $32 WTI price. So at that same price level, the PPT as proposed would have a little bit lower effective tax rate than what we've had historically. Of course, at higher price levels, if you look over to the $72 column, you'd get a little bit higher rate.
And the 2020 tax rate here we're talking about with all the bells and whistles, the 73 and the everything
through else. The chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Representative McGarrett, we'd like to, after this question, we'd like to, if you have a clarification question, that's fine, but Barry says we can get through the entire presentation, your questions will probably get answered, but go ahead, Representative McGarrett.
On the break-even point, it's easier for me to understand things in terms of if it were implemented this year, so FY 2007. Can you give us an estimate of where the break-even point would be if we did a 2020 PPT in this coming year?
Just for 1 year?
Uh-huh. Would it be a higher price than 350?
Yes. Yes. Off the top of my head, I can't tell you, but I could provide that answer later on. I've also looked at the potential, we're forecasting here, and one of the big elements in this forecast, aside from volume and price, are costs. That cost is a big part of it. How much is it going to cost to develop these fields? What are they going to spend in capital? How much does it cost to operate these fields? So what I've looked at is sort of a downside sensitivity to say, what if we're wrong on costs and they are much higher than we think? And I've used 20% here, which seemed to me to be a reasonable bound on how far off we might be. I think we've done a good job at estimating costs, but things change, and different fields have different dynamics to them. But if I'm off by 20%, then you can see then of course you'll collect less under the PPT. And I think probably the easiest way to look at it is if you look over at those break-even columns. They go to 34.60 and 32.50, so it pretty much raised the break-even price by $4 a barrel relative to the status quo.
And if costs decrease, they go back down by the same percentage?
That'd be correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to decrease by the same kind of percentage. But I wanted to sort of look at a worst case scenario. We've also looked at the impact of. There's been a lot of talk about a 25-20, and of course that was what Dr. Van Muers had suggested. So we have looked at the 25-20, and I know as I've watched, I've seen a lot of questions about what that would be. So I thought we would give you the numbers that we calculated at 25-20, and you'll see at the EIA forecast again, the same picture we looked at earlier. So I won't go through all the details. I'll just note down below that the effective tax rate here would be 16% under a 25-20 scenario versus the status quo of 6.3. And I will compare before we're done the 25-20 with the 2020 for you. Here again, I've added in the first half of 2006 to show you what that amount is under a 25-20 scenario. That's about $782 million for the first half. This next slide looks again at various prices, what the 25-20 would result in various prices. And here you can see, let's go first to the low price scenario. You can see that the effective tax rate there is about 13.6% under the 25-20. Again, I go to that low price because it's about, in real terms, the same price that we've had historically for Alaskan crude. And our historical average rate's been about 12%. So you see here the 25-20 at that low price would put you just for the next 10 years a little bit above that historical average. It would put you, if you look at the bottom box, 2007 through 2030, just slightly under it. Going over to the right, if we look at the break-even scenarios, you'll see that the break-even price comes down.
Maybe it's counterintuitive, but I'm just not understanding. Why does the break-even point go down under 25-20?
It goes down because we're going to be taxing at a higher rate, and so we will get more revenues sooner as prices start to rise. Oh. Yeah, and it turns out to be about $1.50 per barrel difference. So I think that's a good way to think about it. It's about the break-even point's about $1.50 a barrel lower under the 25-20 than it is on the 2020. The next chart shows a comparison between a 25-20 rate and a 2020 at the EIA-based forecast price. So the difference that you see here is the difference between a 25-20 and 2020. Again, all in real 2006 dollars. I believe on the charts that you have, there is a labeling problem at the very bottom. The bottom row, I think, on your hard copy shows 25-20, mm-hmm. and it should really be 2020. And the row above that shows 2020, but should say 25-20. We'll get you a replacement copy for that. But here you can see that under the 25-20, the effective tax rate the next 10 years is about 16% at that projected WTI price of nearly $54 a barrel, whereas under the 2020, the effective tax rate would be 12.4% at that same price level, and about $450 million per year difference between the two. This chart I've added in the first half of 2006, so you can see that the difference between the two rates for that first half would be about $305 million. In this chart, really parallels some of the earlier ones. I'm looking at the difference at different price levels between the 2520 and a 2020. Again, I just note the if you look at the $35 case, you've got it under the 2020 an effective tax rate of about 13.6% in the next 10 years. Versus under the 2020, it'd be about 10.3%. So you're straddling the historical average at about the same kind of price level. The next chart deals with government take. And here I've shown the government take percentages under the status quo and under a 2020 and a 2520 tax at different price levels. What you'll see here is that, and this has been talked about by others, under the status quo, government take as you move up in price is a little regressive, whereas under the PPT, either a 2020 or a 2520, the regressivity pretty much goes away. On the left, I've shown total government take. On the right, I've shown Alaska take. So what's taking out the overall regressivity in the under the PPT scenarios is that Alaska take is going up as prices go up. So, but it's going up just enough to sort of offset the overall regressivity of the system, which comes in really through royalties and through property taxes. The next chart is really just, I think, something is a reference tool for folks. I heard a question in, asked of someone if you could take and look at different tax rates and could you interpolate between the lines that people were showing on the graphs? Was it linear or was there something else? So I wanted to give you sort of a little menu here. And this could be expanded out if you wanted to. But what I've shown in the top half of this box is tax impacts over the next 10 years at different price levels and at different PPT tax rates. So starting with the top left corner, you see I've got $40, a row of $40, and that column label 2 is a PPT of 2020. If you work across that $40 row, you'll see the tax, of course, increases as the PPT goes from 2020 to 2520. If you look in what's labeled as column 8, you'll see that it says change per percent increase in tax rate.
Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But I just want to make sure I'm inferring this correctly. This suggests that as the rate goes up, that you're not participating in a decline in production that's driven by tax rate increases.
That's correct. That's just holding the production constant.
And that part's anybody's guess.
I don't know. It's certainly a question mark. Our view, as we've looked at this, I think generally we view either ends of these spectrum as being not onerous. Rates, they wouldn't be discouraging, at least at most price levels. So you might get a little bit around the edges with some marginal stuff, but probably not a big drop-off as percentage-wise. But again, assuming you held production constant, the increment as you go from 1% to another is fixed. So at $40, that increment is $58 million per year. And then if you move down, you'll see that the next row, I've got a $45 level in there.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. You said 58 million per year. You meant
right.
Per point.
per percentage point increase, that's right. These are stated in millions of dollars per year. So if the difference between a 2020 and a 2120, if the price stayed at $40 and the production stayed the same, I would get for 1 year $58 million more under a 2120 versus a 2020. And then that amount will stay constant as the tax rate changes. Now, of course, that amount will change if price levels are different. So what I've shown you here is what that amount would be at different price levels. And these are all, again, WTI price levels.
You, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
That was a remark I think we heard from Mr. Hanley, and if you could just validate this for me, when he was presenting from Anadarko, he said that a $10 swing in price on a barrel of oil was much more significant than the tax rate, and this chart would tend to bear that out, that the movement in the price of a barrel of oil is more significant than a point in taxation. Is that a true statement?
That's correct.
Okay.
The far column over there, labeled column 9, I've shown you what a change in the credit rate would do. So every percent increase in the credit, the bottom number, would reduce revenues on average by $13.6 million at assumed investment. So if investment's higher, that number goes up. If investment's lower, that number would go down. And then finally, if you look at the bottom of each of those boxes, it says change per dollar increase in WTI. It didn't need to say WTI, but just per dollar increase, really, at any given as the price goes up for any given dollar increase, you've got the increase in the tax that you would get. So as price goes up by a dollar a barrel under a 20% rate, you get a $52.1 million additional. Okay. I want to come back to this first graph that we started with, which is the historical and projected tax rate under status quo. And now I want to look at that projected rate. And what I've done here is I've drawn, this is for the next 10 years, I've drawn as a starting point the historical rate as a function of prices. Now, as we know, under the current system, the rate doesn't change with prices. So what you've got here really is a line going straight across at 12%, and that is invariant to prices. That won't happen under the PPT, but that's how the current system works. Contrast that with the projected rate under the status quo. The historical rate is 12%, projected rate next 10 years 6.3%. Now let's bring in the 2020. And see how that looks over the next 10 years. And this shows you crossover points, and it shows you the progressivity that's built into the system as it sits. First thing to note is that you've got a crossover point there above the projected status quo at about $30.50. And you've got a crossover relative to the historical rate at about $52 a barrel WTI. And again, that just bring it back, that historical rate corresponds with about a $32 WTI price. Now, you'll see a funny looking kink in there where the effective rate under the PPT goes down. That is the transition credit. So as you move up, and you break the $40 mark, is actually at about $42 WTI, 40 ANS, that transition credit will start to kick in.
And that's 100% for 5 years.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. So if that was a different, if it was greater, then you'd have a steeper decline down. If it was lower, you'd have a flatter line there. You wouldn't see as much of a dip.
It won't be greater.
Then it will be a flatter line. As it sits now, you need about to recover that in the four-year period, it takes about a $4 increase in price.
Thank you.
That's about how much that's worth. I've added here in this next chart what the 2520 would look like. And you can see it has different crossover points. It has a little bit different curve to it. And in fact, the dip down corresponds to the transition credit would be greater under this, because you would have a higher tax rate, so the credit would be greater. The crossover point relative to the projected status quo is about the 2750 level. Relative to historical rates, it's a little bit over $35 is the crossover. I want to talk a little bit about progressivity. As I've sat and listened to the testimony, I know there's been a lot of talk about by various people about whether there should be a 2020 or a 2520, or should there be something different? Should there be an additional feature built into it? Is this progressive enough? And so we have, in talking with Mr. Johnson and with talking with others, thought about that and put some things, potential, I call it a hybrid rate in here, or plan that has as a part of it the base 2020 PPT, and then it has a sliding scale severance tax that would be in addition to the PPT that, and I'm going to show you a number of different alternatives, but first I just want to talk about the concept. Now, one could accomplish this, let me just preface this, if one was interested in doing something like this, adding some progressivity here, or effectively having a higher tax rate at higher prices, that's what we're talking about progressivity. One could do it in a variety of ways. I'm going to present you an option that, at least as we've looked at it and thought about it, makes sense to us. And it's on this next slide. I would call it example of tax with sliding scale. How this would work is that it would be a percentage increase per dollar over a base threshold level. What I've got here is the assumption I'm going to use at the start is, assume we had a tax that was equal to 0.25% per dollar over any time the price of WTI was over $45. That's the threshold. Let's also assume that the price of WTI is $55 in whatever month we're looking at. That, based on current costs, that would net back to the wellhead at about $47. And let's also assume we've got a base tax of a PPT of 2020. With the sliding scale tax, it would be in addition to the PPT, but since it would be consistent with the way the PPT is structured, it would be deductible against the PPT. It would be like a royalty or a property tax. It's a tax that's deductible against the PPT. If WTI is less than or equal to that threshold price, there'd be no additional tax, so it would just be the curve that you just saw. If WTI is greater than the threshold price, the additional tax would be 0.25% per dollar over the threshold times the gross wellhead value. So sort of consistent with how current the current severance is done. And if you work through the numbers down below using these assumptions, that would amount to an additional, at a $55 WTI price, additional 94 cents per barrel in taxes. Now, I want to show you how that would look visually using the pictures we've just been going through. So what you see here that you've got this sort of a magenta line now that comes up. It goes over the 2020 base starting at $45.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just confused on the last slide. Before, I thought we were told the difference between the A&S price, we can assume, and the WTI price was about $2 a barrel?
That's correct.
Am I incorrect in saying that you're assuming a $55 WTI price is a $47 A&S price?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, there's about a $2 difference between WTI and A&S on the West Coast. So WTI is sold at Cushing, Oklahoma. That's where these prices are all collected and monitored.
Well, okay.
Yeah, there's about, right now, there's about an $8 difference.
So in terms of an A&S price, are you doing a projection on the additional tax kicks in at $45 a barrel A&S wellhead?
No, it would kick in any time WTI is over $45.
WTI.
Yeah, right. Yeah, this is just a system. One could structure it based on A&S wellhead. But this is a system that works off of WTI. I think there's some reasons to do that, but you could do it several different ways.
Thank you.
So going back to the picture, you see that the tax kicks in here at $45. And what it does is essentially changes the slope of that line. And you heard Mr. Marks talk early in his presentation about don't focus so much on crossover points. Focus on slope. They're both important. And what this does is at higher prices, it changes the slope. As an example here, if we're at $55, for instance, under the 2020, you would have an effective tax rate of 12.5%. If you had this sliding scale feature with it, that would go up to 14.5%. So it would be essentially 80% of the 2.5% increase, and it's 80% because the sliding scale tax is deductible under the PPT. Now, and then you can also see here you would cross the 25-20 line at just under $65 WTI. So as prices are up there, by their historical, near their historical highs that we have today, you'd be crossing the 25-20 line. Now, you can have a different slope on something like this. Here I've got an example where you start with the $45, but you have, instead of having a 0.25% per dollar scale, you'd have a 0.35% per dollar. And what that does is it starts at the same point, but you have a higher rate as you increase with the dollars. So here you see you cross, with this kind of slope, you'd cross the 25-20 at about $57 a barrel WTI. And then finally, I've added a line in here just to see, well, maybe you could start with a different threshold price. So what if you started with 40 and you used the same 0.25%? And I appreciate that this is getting to be a lot of lines on the chart, so I'm not going to go beyond this. But that line that I've just added there, which starts at 40, and it's the orangish-looking line, you'll see that it rises parallel to that first line I put on there, the magenta line, because they're both a 0.25% per dollar scale. They just start at different points. But of course you'll have, if you start at a lower point with the same rate, you'll have a higher tax at higher prices. So these are some thoughts on how one could go about structuring something that had a progressive feature to it that would kick in at higher prices.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I love seeing all this, but if I could correlate this to total government take, where this would put us with total government take, that's the...
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, I'm going to get to that in the last slide I do.
Okay.
You've anticipated... this next chart is identical to what you've just seen, but here I'm plotting the numbers out over the period through 2030. And again, I would discount those numbers relative to the 10-year projection unless there's some reason that you're particularly concerned about those out years. Let's look at a bunch of numbers. I've put a table together here that tries to bracket these different concepts. And what I've got, if you look at the left side of the table, I've got different price levels for WTI ranging from $30 to $80
And again, these are in 2006 prices. And the next column over, column one, shows you the effective tax rate that we expect under the status quo, so 4.9%. And then in column two, which I've highlighted in yellow, that's the effective tax rate under a 2020 PPT at different prices. Everything to the right shows you the effective tax rate that you would get by implementing a sliding scale at a given threshold price with different increments. So for instance, in column three, that is a example of the what you would get at a $35 threshold with a 0.2% increment per dollar. And you can just look down the column and see how that changes with price. And I've done that for thresholds of 35, 40, down below 45 and 50, and then at increments of 0.2 through 0.35. And I've highlighted here down below where the 25-20 would get you. So you can look at each of these different, you can use this sort of as a menu. Look at these and see where numbers cross and how they relate to either the 2020 or 2520.
Representative Berkowitz?
I'm sorry, the bottom half is 2020, it says 2520.
Yeah, it's maybe, I tried to get a lot of information on one sheet. Normally I would have liked to put this all out in one, just in one one set of rows, but the highlighted boxes are the 2020 on top and 2520 below. Okay,
2520 with no sliding scale.
No sliding. There's no sliding scales built into the two yellow columns there. I'm sorry. We had to replace this chart, and I guess the replacement doesn't have the yellow highlighting.
Thank you.
So we'll get you a yellow highlighted copy.
No, that's okay. Just need better eyes.
Ages are terrible.
My arms are
The way you need to think about this is that bottom section. Think about that as just coming up and being appended to the right of the top section. We just had to break it this way so we could get it all on one page for you. So the top section is showing the 2020 and then sliding scales at a 35 and 40 threshold. The bottom section is showing you 2520 and then sliding scales at a 45 and 50. And I know it's a lot of information to have there, but it's as you saw from the earlier pictures, if I put all these lines on a chart for you, it would ultimately be meaningless after you get through a couple of lines. So this is done in a data format that I think is easier ultimately to digest. A note about some of these, again, to go back, the higher the increment level, as you move from 0.2 to 0.25 to 0.3, 0.35, that's going to ratchet your slope up. So for any given dollar increase, the slope is going to ratchet up. You can think about these, I like to think about these actually in terms of $10 increases. So a 0.2 increment per dollar is a 2% increment per $10. 0.35 per dollar would be 3.5% per $10. What I've shown here on the chart are the increments in per dollar. So if we look at column three, for instance, what that says is the sliding scale would kick in at a $35 price, and it would increment by 0.2% per dollar above 35. So if you were at 45, which is $10 above 35, that total increment would be 2%, so 10 times 0.2. So if you take any of these increment percentages here, you see, and just multiply them by 10, move the decimal point over 1, really, you'll get the impact per $10. And that may be an easier way for folks to think about it.
Representative Rammers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Baron, let me back it off just a little bit from being so myopically on this chart. Somewhere between your suggestion is that at 2020 and at 2520, you don't disturb industry's evaluation of whether investment in Alaska is economic or not. And that was the beginning where you said the models were at a $30 stress price, $40 base price. I asked you about 50. You said, well, the model's not necessarily symmetric in that way. and that it's a guess that forecasters have been burned over time. So what this suggests is that if you clear the hurdle of the economic decisions of industry, of whether 25 million barrel or 500 million barrel field or economic or not, if you clear that hurdle, then if you go into this progressivity, whether it's 0.2 or 0.25 or 0.3 or 0.35, then you're sharing in the windfall profits after that. But you have kind of cleared the space of where the oil companies in their boardrooms are making their decisions of whether or not it's economic to invest in Alaska.
Yeah. I mean, you're doing any tax system you put into place, they will evaluate with exactly that in mind. Having something like this is a different one they would have to evaluate. But what it would do is that they would know at lower levels, whatever level below this threshold you put in here, whether it be 35 or 40 or 45, whatever, that the rate would be, there would be no increase in the marginal rate.
All right. Again, just an IRA. If any of us at this table had an IRA, our retirement that we're trying to project. You know, they say that at age 20, you can be aggressive and go all in stocks. And at age 40, it's a mix of stocks and bonds. And at age 60, you better be real careful with your nest egg because you've got to stretch out. So if we're selecting a place on this spectrum of prices per barrel, and this is our nest egg, we cannot jeopardize it at all. The whole point of PPT is to incentivize exploration and more investment dollars coming to Alaska to keep the pipe full. Where along that spectrum are we safe? 30 is a stress price, 40 is a base price. Some of your models went as high as 45. What's the safe number where we're behaving like a 60-year-old? Protecting the nest egg of their IRA. Where's that number along the spectrum?
Our view, we sat down with the administration folks who came up with the PPT, Dr. Van Muers, and considered those very questions when he was first submitting his recommendations. Mm-hmm. And in our view, certainly the 2020 was very safe, very safe. The 2520 we even thought was safe.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I meant a price per barrel of oil.
Oh, I'm sorry.
For economics, not the tax program, but the price per barrel of oil. 30 is a stress, 40 is a base. Where do we clear the hurdle on the other side where we're inside of all the boardroom projections along their bell curve?
Well, I think in that 35 to 40 range is about right. But you also need, I think, that's a long-term average. Within that, you're going to have, you know, prices lower and prices higher. The notion behind the kind of system that people have talked about, the progressivity, is that when prices are higher, you share in that. And when they're lower, you share in that as well. I think as far as an average, what Dr. Finizza has indicated that people are looking at today, to make investment decisions, 35 to 40. That clears the hurdle for investment decisions. Now, do they think they're hoping for some upside, right? And that's one of the reasons they do it. It as part of that analysis, they're looking at the upside. They may not think that the upside's there with 100% certainty, and certainly they discount it. But they make it because there is a potential for upside. There's a pretty good chance, they think, at 40, I'm going to do well on this. And down at 30, I'm not going to lose my shirt. But boy, I'd sure like that upside. I mean, we all would like the upside. That's what we're talking about here. And how do you balance that between the state getting a part of the upside and investors getting a part of the upside? And it is a balance. It is a balance. If you make it too steep, then investors will look at that. They'll plug that into their formulas, and they'll say, okay, what am I going to walk away with? And if oil goes to $80 a barrel, because that's part of my decision making, and there's some chance it's going to go to 80, what's it going to look like for me? Well, if you're going to take everything away from me above $40 a barrel, you're not that attractive. If you're going to take a little bit more away from me as price goes up, that's okay. That's pretty consistent with what happens around the world. If you take too much away from me, you get you get less attractive. So it's striking that balance. And again, if you look at this in light of the work that was done by Dr. Van Muers and our review of it, we certainly thought that the 25-20 would not result in rates or tax rates or government take that would be discouraging at price levels that you might see. And even as you get on the upside, certainly wouldn't be discouraging. You're not taking away too much of the upside. And consistent with what Mr. Johnson has said, even as you get into the very high prices, taking away, having a higher increment on that is not going to be discouraging either. You don't want to get too high. I would say, and then to end it off, in general, to the extent, again, and to give a big caveat here, Dr. Finis and I are not fiscal system planners, as you've heard from some. We are mere economists, and so approach this with approach it cautiously. Higher taxes, in general, you have to find the balance. That's the key. You are out there as a state trying to. Your goal, I think, is and should be to maximize the value of this resource for the state of Alaska, and that involves finding a balance between having a rate that is high enough to keep people interested here, not so high that you start to lose a lot of interest. Losing a little bit of interest may not be bad, but depending on what the total revenue pie is. But you don't want to lose a lot of interest. And as economists who have worked with forecasting and looking at decision making, I think our view would also be you don't want to be in a position where you've calculated that you've taken every last penny of what's available. You want to leave something. You want to make it attractive. You want to leave enough to make it attractive, keep people real interested. We don't think the 25-20 goes beyond that at all. And then with some increment on above that, we think it still stays real attractive. Now, in thinking about the sliding scale, what would you do? I think our view in general would be, if you're thinking about starting it lower, have a lower increment. If you're thinking about starting it higher, have a higher increment. That probably just is a general thing. Otherwise, if you start real low and have a real high increment, you go pretty steep. So that would be our
Representative Gatto.
Just looking at the maximum prices you have here, if we explode this view and say oil is above 80, 100, let's just say, does your chart essentially stop at 80 and say we no longer incrementalize the next dollar?
Our charts stop at 80. The calculations can easily be extended beyond 80.
I'm looking for your suggestion, because these are your charts. Did you mean it to stop at 80, or
yes,
did you mean it to say beyond 80, count every $5 and extend it?
Extend it like this. You might, there could become a level where you would cap it and say we're just not going to, we're going to have some cap out there. But remember, $80 here, these are real prices. That's, you're looking, if you have $80 real prices, out 20 years, you're over $100 a barrel. So it's a, this allows for some pretty healthy pricing in here.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And so just to be clear, within these scenarios, are there any of them that you've projected here that you think are, from your standpoint of being your analysis, that would be detrimental to investment in the industry here in Alaska?
No. Looking at these, I don't see any that would fall into the detrimental area. I put, as I look at this, I try and put these into historical context. look at what rates have been at given price levels. And as you look at those, even if you look at the highest one of these that you'd have, which would be the 35 threshold with a 0.35% increment, you see as you know, when you're at $40 prices there, your tax rate is only 11.4%. That's at a higher price level. That's a lower percentage than your historical average. You start to ratchet up beyond there, but you've got some pretty high prices that those are associated with. So there might be a little bit of stuff around the margin that would look at that and say that's not of interest. I don't think for the majority of what you have that would be the case. But I can see reasons why you wouldn't do that either. I mean, there you might have a more cautious approach.
Representative Crawford and then Rammers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I may be the biggest pessimist here, but I think that within the next couple of years, we're going to settle somewhere between $20 and $30 a barrel for the next several years out. All these scenarios that you're laying out for us are much higher than that. What would this tax do to us at a $20 to $30 a barrel range?
When you say, through the chair, Representative Crawford, when you say $20 to $30, are you talking about ANS Wellhead or ANS West Coast or?
ANS West Coast.
ANS West Coast at in the 20 range. If it's $20 a barrel, you lose. You'll
how much do we lose?
I can get you that answer pretty quickly. I don't have it at my fingertips, but our model will quickly calculate that. But you will lose relative to the system that's in place today. You will lose on service taxes. You will obviously royalties will be low. I mean, I think Mr. Mark said at $20 a barrel, you've got a lot of problems.
Oh, yeah.
Bigger problems than just that. This system at $20 a barrel is more beneficial to the producers than the status quo system is. At $30 a barrel, you're in the just about above the break-even range relative to what's projected. Now, you're not break-even relative to what you had historically. Remember, historically, for real $32 WTI, you've had about 12% taxes. So, and that'd be about a $30 West Coast price.
It's a mighty scary scenario you're laying out for us here.
Representative Rammers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, I'm looking at your business cards. West 5th Street in L.A., 10 Monarch Bay Drive in Dana Point. So, Doctor, I'll come back to you with this question. This is about the future. 660,000 Alaskans. You opened with an example of your almanac test. Are you sure? As you throw out these numbers and you play with the future of a sales tax, a state income tax, the most valuable resource we have, which is the North Slope production, are you sure? How sure are you?
Chairman Rammers, I would have to say that as an example, the scenario just thrown out about $20 oil, I am not sure about that. But if you told me the certainty was going to be $20, I would say you have a high chance of losing. But I have no idea if it's going to be minus 20. That's a credible, although I believe low probability case, I'm not sure about that.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
If I could answer Chairman Rammers also, we are assuming here that, as with all tax systems, you try to anticipate the future and tailor your system as best you can. But if the future turns out to be different than what you expect, you can alter it and should alter it to make sure you strike the right balance. If you told me, however, that I cannot change the future, this decision is one I have to stick with for a long time, then, or at least this is one, it's taxes. Once you make a decision, you're not going to be able to raise them. You may be able to lower them, but if you're constrained against raising them, I think that should enter into your your calculation of where along this you go to the less aggressive end or the more aggressive end. If you can't raise them realistically in the future, if you find out that you were wrong, then you would be better off, I think, to be on the more aggressive side, knowing that you could come back and lower them. If that's not a constraint, then if you've been too conservative at the outset, you can revisit it and look at it and do it again. But I am mindful of the fact that it is hard as legislators, I know, to raise taxes. It's easier to lower them than it is to raise them.
Representative Berkowitz and then Gatto.
Thanks very much. I'm looking at a publication called State Taxation, Exploration, and Production in the U.S. Oil Industry by a number of economists from Wyoming, and their conclusion is that oil production is quite inelastic with respect to changes in state severance taxes. And I don't expect absolute 100% certainty from you all. My dad's an economist. I know that the only thing certain is that I'm going to have to clean something at some point. But my question is, would you agree with that conclusion that severance taxes and oil really don't have much impact on one another?
I think that's without – I would, before giving you an ultimate conclusion there, I'd like to read what is said there. But I think, in general, the state severance tax is a smaller bite. And so movements in that tax rate don't have a big impact, and I would expect that's right, that things would be relatively insensitive to that. There are, I mean, as you get to a point, you may get into more sensitivities, but yes, in general, a change within a certain range, I think, would be just as they described. Something that I think might help, Chairman Samuels and Chairman Ramirez, is to look at what government take does under these different scenarios, because that shows you, as you're moving these effective tax rates, what is going on with the government take, and particularly for these legacy type fields, that's something I know that the folks who think about these things and how fiscal systems ought to operate look at that pretty heavily. So this shows you at the different prices where government take would be. And you can look, let's look back at that. Unfortunately, it looks like the header on the top is missing. But if you look over, I believe it was, yes, column 6 would be the $35 threshold with the 0.35% increment. So it would be the lowest threshold and the highest increment that we've put on there. You'll see that as you get to $50 a barrel, you've got a government take of about just under 60%. As you're at $80 a barrel, you've got a government take of 64.5%. As I've heard and understand Dr. Van Muers and Mr. Johnson, at least in their view, those kinds of takes are not something that would make you less competitive than opportunities elsewhere.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. We go to the doctor and we say, I got an ache in my shoulder. And we essentially pay him the way we pay you to get advice, not anything but advice, which we then make some direction out of. So much of what we're doing here really depends on the price of oil. And actually, we would like you to tell us, which we're not going to ask, what is the price of oil going to be? But you're a company that does this. In other words, you know, based on projections, what the world population will be in 20 years. Somewhere out there, and we just came back from a conference, they talked about 6.3 billion people. If you take a look at the Venezuelan production potential, you look at Saudi production potential, you look at Alberta, and you look at refining capacity, and you start to get an idea that an awful lot of new Chinese people are going to be buying cars, and they're not going to be buying hybrids. You take all this data, and you can pretty much take an educated guess of what a barrel of oil is going to be worth in 10 years. I guess that's what I'm asking you to say. Have you, and I'm hoping you have, taken as many of these variables together to say, listen, your $20 oil is a pipe dream. it's just never going to happen? Or are you saying, given this circumstance, but I don't know what circumstance could exist that would give us a bigger supply of oil worldwide compared to a devastating accident or terrorist incident that would literally demolish the world supply of oil? Where do you go from here? Have you done this much work?
And we have some guarantees.
In just 2 weeks.
Representative Gatto, we do not forecast crude oil prices because we don't want to be embarrassed by being wrong. But we do know that there's a wide range of uncertainty. I mean, that's the best we can do. And this is, to me, is what I put up there, a chart I already have shown about the uncertainty about WTI that the government analysis, which has as many people as you can imagine working on this, looking at all those variables, have come up with. And the best they can do is there's somewhere in the 30 to 80 real range, you're going to be 60% of the time. I personally think maybe the uncertainty is wider than that, given all the other variables I've heard around this room, all credible, low probabilities. You have to put your money down, just like in Las Vegas. I don't think I would personally bet that prices will be permanently $20 and below for a long time. I would also say there's a high chance it will be there for a moment or two, for a year. I wouldn't bet my money on $100 oil either. And I won't say that it's not going to be there. I think you have to operate in a reasonable planning space. And the planning space is confounded by the fact that you have to be in the same shoes as the people that make decisions. They're not making decisions, I don't believe, on $60 oil. The people who are making decisions on $60 oil are auto companies. That's their stress test. Should be. Oil companies are stressing it. They will go out of business at 20. They can't explore at 20. They're not betting on 50. You shouldn't bet on 50 either.
And if I can add to Dr. Finis's answers, I don't think that the system, I think one of the things I've heard from people who design these systems, and it makes sense to me, is that to the extent you can have a system that is flexible over a wide price range and doesn't cause people on either side pain on when prices are low or prices are high, inordinate pain, that is a system that is fairer and that is more likely to last going forward. So when prices are under any of these systems, under the type of system that's been proposed here, you're taking on more risk by going to this system. You're taking on the risk that you haven't taken on before. That's not necessarily a bad thing. You're big boys and girls.
Let's get to one last question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. William. I'm going to ask you the $64 million question while we have you here. You saw what Mr. Johnson said. He said something like 25-20 and then higher at higher prices. But I want to hear what you have to say. If you were to recommend to us a tax rate structure, what is your best estimate of what tax rate and credit, 25-20, 20-20, 30-20, what tax rate and credit would work out to maximize revenue for us in the long term? And then what sort of sliding scale structure would you recommend, recognizing that we could do a lower price and a higher increment or a higher price and a lower increment? But could you give us sort of your best advice to us for maximizing long-term revenue for a tax rate, and if you agree with it, a sliding scale rate too, and credit rate? What kind of PPT we should look at?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we don't have a single rate. Again, as I said before, we are not designers of fiscal systems. We can look at fiscal systems and try and anticipate what the reaction would be, both in terms of state revenues and in terms of the investment decisions that are being made. Personally, I would I'm going to go back to an answer I gave to Chairman Samuels. If I wasn't constrained, if you told me I can, just as a normal tax, I can revisit this and see how it's working, I wouldn't be too concerned about going one way or the other. My personal inclinations would be to be a little more conservative and look and see how it's working and see how prices are coming out and what I've done, to how investment has responded. But that's in part a personal preference as to how these things should work. But I'm not in your chairs, and you may have different preferences on that. I think, again, as long as you can revisit it, you can be a little bit wrong and change it. If, however, you find it hard to revisit or hard to raise taxes, I think that pushes you a little bit the other way, to start on the higher end, knowing that you can't, as a practical matter, raise them very easily. But if it's causing some pain, you're going to hear about it. You're going to hear about it whether it's causing pain or not. You're going to hear that it's causing pain. If I was producing oil in North Slope, I would be telling you the very same thing. Any tax is a bad tax, and I don't want to pay more taxes. I mean, we all feel that way. We don't want to pay more taxes than we absolutely have to. But they're a fact of life. So you're going to hear, no matter what you put in place, that it's causing pain. You need to look at the behavior and see. And you need to look closely at the behavior because see why, if it is causing pain, why. I hope I've given you enough of an answer there. I know I didn't give you a number. But I think the numbers that we threw out, I think personally we would probably tend to be not use that lowest threshold and highest increment rate. We would probably be more, 40 to 45 with a mid-level increment rate. But again, that's a lot of that is just really personal feeling about where you should be and what, with the idea in mind that you can revisit it. But it does, it moves you, and Mr. Johnson would probably say, what you've just described, Mr. Pulliam, gets you to the end of the last century, and it doesn't put you where everyone is today. That may be, but and there's nothing wrong with that view at all. And again, I say if you can, you're changing your system dramatically. But I think it's a good change. I mean, there's going to be some challenges here, and this is going to have to be implemented by the Department of Revenue. We didn't get a chance to talk about Section 20. That's a challenge. I think they're going to have to pay special attention to how that gets implemented. The cost issues. People don't have to monitor these costs and understand them. They're good people at Department of Revenue and Department of Natural Resources, and they'll do their best to try and get it right. But it's going to be a challenge, and so it's wise to allow yourself the opportunity to revisit it, see how it's doing.
Dr. Finitz.
I just add one comment here. I agree with what Barry said here. My personal feeling might be to start with the lower combination and then have some kind of sliding scale, because you can, in fact, simulate at high prices the higher rate. So you kind of have some way the best of both worlds at higher prices, where the pain on the oil industry won't be that great. But start out with the low one to make sure that you don't incur unnecessarily the pain at lower prices, and also protect yourself that right. In a busted lower price scenario, you don't start giving too many tax credits away.
That's right. Remember, at 25, if prices are down at $20 a barrel at a 25% tax rate, that may be worse for the state. I mean, you're giving more back.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What Mr. Johnston was telling us was that discounted for our transportation prices and the quality of our crude and that sort of thing, that about a 65% total government take was what would keep us in the worldwide average, something along mm-hmm. that line. It would seem to me that we would want to construct a tax that you started out at the 65% of government take and take it backwards from there to construct the tax to reach that, not to construct a tax and then you reach these numbers here that run 57, 56, 59, mm-hmm. I mean, that percentage point. I mean, it seems to me like we're leaving a lot of money on the table if what we're trying to do is get somewhere near the worldwide average, discounted for quality and transportation prices.
If your objective is to get to be the worldwide average on government take, then you would go about this in a different way. I agree. I think that in my mind, the government take figures are of interest to look at to see where you fall. Are you potentially going to drive folks away if you get your take up too high? But I don't know there's anything magical about being at the average. I mean, you could be a little low below the average. You might want to be. You could be a little bit above the average. You might want to be. There's some in that. I mean, again, as Dr. Venetia talked about, the average is based on, it's got some extremes in there. You've got the Gulf of Mexico, for instance, in there that's very low. You've got other places in the world that are very high where there's a lot of oil to go after. You know, there's a limited amount of places where you can go and find oil these days, and a lot of those places have very high takes, and there are a lot of them are much higher than anything you're talking about here. So if you wanted to be like those, you would push things harder. I think that's what Mr. Johnson would tell you.
Okay, well, just speaking for myself, I've been here for 3 weeks every day listening to economists and tax lawyers for 4 hours a day, and then the other 4 hours in that office right there listening to the economists and tax lawyers. And by far and away, you had the most digestible one. I don't know if you had the advantage of going last or if you're just more personable guys. I don't know which one it is.
I think it's the latter.
I think
it's the latter.
So with that, I thank you both very much. I know you guys need to take a little break before you go down the hall, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.